Exodus, chapters 35 and 36, the 34th talk in a series on Exodus, was presented by David Crabtree on March 11, 2018, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 32, Exodus 35 and 36, accompanies this talk.
Okay, we're getting towards the end of Exodus. We've got six chapters yet to go, and I'm going to do two chapters this week. I'm going to do four chapters next week, and then I'm going to talk about Exodus as a whole the following week. I'm going to start with some preparatory remarks before we launch into this last section. I've been wondering for over a year how I was going to teach this last section of Exodus. In the past, whenever I've read through Exodus and I get to this part, I just skim through it and sprint to the end. Because, as we'll see, it's quite repetitive, and it doesn't have a whole lot of interest to it. So by that time, I'm just eager to be done with the book, and I go through quickly. And it's always seemed to me like Moses was just fulfilling some kind of requirement to write this stuff down, and just kind of rotely going through the motions. So I considered basically skipping these last four chapters and just spending a very short period of time on them. That's what most of the commentaries do, is they really cut down on the pages when they go through these sections. But when I began to work through the passages slowly and carefully, and there were some things that I found in the commentaries that were very helpful, I was quite surprised at what I discovered. And I have now reached the conclusion that without the end of Exodus, it would be a very different book. That the end makes a huge difference, and that's what I hope to demonstrate. So before we get into these next two chapters, there's some background information that'll be helpful to set the stage for what I think is going on here. And what I'm going to ask you to do is to consider the possibility that there are very different cultural assumptions that are behind this last section than we would typically carry into it. And if you look at the section through those cultural assumptions, it really transforms it, and it becomes quite different than it would otherwise appear to be. So I'm going to take a little time to talk about that fact, that change, and how we need to look at it through different eyes than we otherwise would. Now, to set the historical context, I just want to remind you and stress the fact that because of the incident with the golden calf, the construction of the tabernacle was in doubt. God had given the instructions as to how it was to be built to Moses when he was up on the mountain, but when he came down from the mountain and the Israelites had sinned greatly. God wanted to destroy them, and the tabernacle, he didn't destroy them. He decided, Moses talked him into not destroying them. But there's still the question, that tabernacle was designed to be the place where God would be in their midst. And God was no longer interested in being in their midst. So that threw up in the air the whole issue of whether there would be a tabernacle or not. It looked like there would not be a tabernacle at that point. So as we've talked about in the last few chapters, Moses went through this process of negotiating with God to bring about a reconciliation. And it's only after that reconciliation is made and a reaffirmation of the covenant is made that it becomes apparent that the tabernacle does need to be built because God is going to be in their midst. Okay, in these last six chapters, there's a lot of repetition. Much of what is said in these last chapters repeats word for word, almost, what was said in chapters 25 through 31. There, God was giving the instructions as to how it was supposed to be built. And now in this section, it goes through and describes, and it says, and X was built. There are even things within these last six chapters that are repeated almost verbatim. There are other chunks that are repeated. So to our ears or eyes, this seems to be very boring at the least and possibly a mistake in the composition. In decades past, scholars who accepted the assumption that the Old Testament was just pasted together from sources, material that had passed down orally through different sources, and what we have in the Old Testament is just the result of someone artlessly putting together those sources. And it was assumed that from one source, we received the description of the temple as it was to be built. From another source, we received a description of the temple as it was built, and those were just slapped together to create what we have in the text now. But to the less skeptical, the repetition appears to have a cultural significance that we would not necessarily pick up on. Generally speaking, the Old Testament historical narratives are very sparse. I would say aggravatingly sparse. I would love to have more details as I'm going through the Old Testament narratives. But they have very few, and whenever they have a detail, I have learned to pay close attention. So why, in a literary form that has nothing superfluous, why would you have these huge sections of repetition? And it would appear that the reason for that is that the repetition stresses the exact implementation of the command that was given. I'm going to read a section from Umberto Casuto. He's the one who, to my knowledge, is the first one who recognized this phenomenon. And this is a fairly lengthy excerpt, but I think it's very helpful. The theme of the founding and building of a shrine was a stereotyped literary category in the early writings of the Eastern countries, and it was usual for such passages to record first the divine utterance describing the plan of the sanctuary in minutest detail, and thereafter to give an account of the construction, which repeated in identical or similar phrasing the description given in the divine communication. This is indeed only a specific facet of the general technique of repetition, which was dearly beloved of the writers of the ancient East. The literary tradition of the land of Canaan, which is continued in biblical writings, is also fond of this practice. It will suffice to cite here one example from the Canaanite works discovered at Ugarit. In the Ugaritic epic of King Carit, it is narrated that this monarch saw El, the father of the gods, in a dream, and received from him instructions concerning the offering of sacrifices, the mustering of a great army, the organization of a military expedition to the land of King Pabel, the request that Pabel's daughter or granddaughter be given him for a wife, and so on and so forth. These directives contain more than 90 lines. At the conclusion of the instructions, we are informed that King Carit did as El had directed him in his dream, and his actions are described by the literal repetition of the terms of the instructions, except for changes in the forms of the verbs to indicate past tense, and other variations of formulation, such as a vav conjunctive more or less, the substitution of synonyms, differences in the sequence of the words, and the like, as well as other divergences arising from the altered character of the narrative. Precisely what we find in the present section of the book of Exodus. In light of this style of composition, our section is not only not to be regarded as a later addition, but it is required where it is, and were it not here, we should have to assume that it was missing from the text. Another commentator wrote this: the reason for the genre is in fact easy enough to see. Elaborate, even tedious repetition forces the reader or listener to agree that a set of important instructions was unquestionably carried out to the letter. In other words, the command fulfillment repetition pattern is a way of highlighting the importance of what is commanded and the precision with which it was obeyed. By implication, the things produced in obedience to the original command must be considered important. They were commanded in great detail and produced in rigorous complicity with the command. In other words, things over which such a great fuss have been made in the text can only be seen as of paramount significance, things neither to be ignored, nor treated lightly, nor taken for granted. Okay, if they're correct, and I think they are, what they're seeing is that given the cultural assumptions of the ancient Near East, this repetition is emphasizing something that's very important. That is, instructions were given that were very detailed by God for them to carry out. And so then what follows is a description of the fact that they were carried out in every detail in which they were given. It's showing delight in the fact that they did what they were told to do. God said to build X, such and such a size, out of such and such a material, build it in such and such a way, and there it's going to be you shall, so the verb is different. When it's done, it's going to be we did X, such and such size, out of such and such materials, in such and such a way. So the author is just showing in great detail, we did everything that we were told to do. But as they point out, the repetition is not just cut and paste. They have not just taken the chunks from the instructions and put those into the implementation part of the text. As I mentioned, the verbs are changed. There are a few details that are changed. I would say very few details, but there are a few. And the order of presentation is changed, and that's the biggest difference. If you go through and look at the commands that were given, you can see in the implementation, there are chunks that are moved around in the implementation stage. And it's generally thought that those changes are made to create interest. Otherwise, it gets a little tedious. I have looked at the change in the order of presentation. And if we divide it up into blocks, these appear to be the blocks in the order in which they occur in the instructions when God gives the command. It starts with the furniture for the inside of the tabernacle. It then gives the instructions for the tabernacle itself, the tent. Then it gives instructions for the furniture outside of the tabernacle in the courtyard. Then it gives instructions for the screen that's supposed to go around the entire courtyard. And then it ends with the priestly garments that are to be made. When it's implemented, oh, and by the way, by progressing in that way, it's going from the holiest, the most holy, to the least holy. It starts with the Ark of the Covenant. It goes to the other furniture inside the tabernacle, then the tabernacle, and it just moves out from that center. So that seems to be the principle of organization that's used in describing when God gave the instructions. When it's talking about the implementation of the commands, it's going to start with the tent, so the tabernacle structure. Then it's going to talk about the furniture inside of the tent. Then it's going to talk about the furniture outside of the tent. Then the screen around the whole courtyard, and then the priestly garments. So the difference here is that the command went from holiest, most holy, to least holy. In the implementation, what seems to be happening is a place for the most holy to be put is first built, and then the most holy things are built and put in it. Then it moves on out the same way. Okay, so that seems to be a more practical ordering rather than a conceptual ordering. All right, so that's what we'll be looking at as we march through the next six chapters. We'll just do two chapters today, starting with Exodus 35, 1 through 3. Then Moses assembled all the congregation of the sons of Israel and said to them, "These are the things that the Lord has commanded you to do. For 6 days' work may be done, but on the seventh day you shall have a holy day, a Sabbath of complete rest to the Lord. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. You shall not kindle a fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day." So the first thing that's said when they're getting ready to build the tabernacle is a reminder that they are not supposed to work on Sabbath. Curiously, the last thing that was said to Moses after God had given all of the instructions for the construction of the tabernacle was a reminder in 31 verses 12 through 17, a reminder that they need to keep the Sabbath. So that the instructions ended with that reminder, and now the implementation begins with that reminder. The Sabbath was clearly intended to play a very important role in their lives, in the lives of the people of Israel. It was intended to provoke reflection, and it was intended to be a reminder. In Exodus 19, when the Ten Commandments are given, God roots the Sabbath day in the fact that God, when he created the world, on the seventh day he rested. In Deuteronomy, when the Ten Commandments are listed, in that context, The Sabbath is rooted in the fact that God, they're to celebrate the Sabbath because God brought the Israelites out of Egypt, out of slavery. So on the one hand, the Sabbath is a reminder of God's creative activity and that he ended his creative activity with a day of rest. But on the other hand, the Sabbath is a reminder of what God had done for them when he brought them out of slavery. Then in Exodus 31:13, it says, with respect to the Sabbath, "For this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you." So this is a reminder of the covenant that God has made with the Israelites. Stuart, one of the commentators I was looking at, says, "Not to keep it would be to say publicly to the world, I am not in covenantal relationship with the Lord of the Sabbath." So the Sabbath has various significances. It's not just one. But it has significances that are food for reflection and significances that they need to be reminded of, the people of Israel need to be reminded of. So the Sabbath plays an important role in their lives. So God's instruction is that the construction of the tabernacle, a holy thing, does not supersede their need to keep the seventh day of the week holy. So the holiness of the Sabbath takes precedence over the holiness of the tabernacle that needs to be constructed. And I'll talk about that more later. The last verse in this section is curious. "You shall not kindle a fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day." That is not in the section at the end of the instructions that God gave. That has been added. So the question is, why would such a thing be added? And presumably, it has something to do with the golden calf. The incident with the golden calf somehow called for this addition to the reminder to keep the Sabbath. There's apparently some indication that the Canaanites, they had an understanding of work, and in their understanding of work, preparatory activity was not considered to be work. And it gives the example. To work with metal, you have to have a very hot fire. To create a very hot fire takes time. So, in the Canaanite conception, creating that hot fire is just preparation for work to be done. It's not work itself. If this is true, if the Israelites were to adopt this conception of work, then they could start their fires on the Sabbath, build them up and get them hot so that they're all ready to go first thing when the Sabbath is over. It would appear, if that's correct, it would appear that this is a warning against making such an adoption of a definition of work that kind of cheats on what God had intended. And presumably that God decided that that was a necessary thing to include as a consequence of having seen what the Israelites did with respect to the golden calf. They need concrete, specific guidance, not to help them to ward off the temptation to adopt more attractive practices from their neighbors. Next section, 4 through 9. And Moses spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, "This is the thing which the Lord has commanded, saying, take from among you a contribution to the Lord. Whoever is of willing heart, let him bring it as the Lord's contribution. Gold, silver, and bronze, and blue, purple, and scarlet material, fine linen, goat's hair, and ram skins dyed red, and porpoise skins, and acacia wood, and oil for lighting, and spices for the anointing oil, and for the fragrant incense, and onyx stones and setting stones for the ephod and for the breastpiece." So Moses is taking up this collection of contributions. This was commanded earlier when God gave the instructions. And when he gave those instructions, he lists these same materials in the same order as we have them here. But there is stress being placed on the fact that these are supposed to be voluntary. Only voluntary contributions are to be taken. And we'll see that this gets emphasized later in the chapter much, much more. Next section, 10 through 19. "And let every skillful man among you come and make all that the Lord has commanded, the tabernacle, its tent and its covering, its hooks and its boards, its bars, its pillars and its sockets, the ark and its poles, the mercy seat and the curtain of the screen, the table and its poles and all its utensils, and the bread of the presence, the lampstand also for the light and its utensils and its lamps, and the oil for its light, for the light, and the altar of incense and its poles, and the anointing oil and the fragrant incense, and the screen for the doorway at the entrance of the tabernacle, the altar of burnt offering with its bronze grating, its poles and all its utensils, the basin and its stand, the hangings of the court, its pillars and its sockets, and the screen for the gate of the court, the pegs of the tabernacle and the pegs of the court and their cords, the woven garments for the ministering in the holy place, the holy garments for Aaron the priest, and the garments of his sons to minister as priests." This now is a to-do list. These are the things that the workmen are going to have to make. There had been a similar list, almost identical list, in when God gave the command. And when he summarized all the tasks that were going to have to be done, it's almost identical to this list here. And we'll see that in the last chapter, when all of the things have been made and they're brought together, Moses gives a list of all the things that were brought together. It is almost identical to this in the same order. Next section, verses 20 through 29. "Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel departed from Moses' presence, and everyone whose heart stirred him and everyone whose spirit moved him came and brought the Lord's contribution for the work of the tent of meeting and for all its service and for the holy garments. Then all whose hearts moved them, both men and women, came and brought brooches and earrings and signet rings and bracelets, all articles of gold. So did every man who presented an offering of gold to the Lord. And every man who had in his possession blue and purple and scarlet material, and fine linen and goat's hair and ram skins, dyed red and porpoise skins, brought them. Everyone who could make a contribution of silver and bronze brought the Lord's contribution. And every man who had in his possession acacia wood for any work of the service brought it. And all the skilled women spun with their hands and brought what they had spun in blue and purple and scarlet material and in fine linen. And all the women whose heart stirred with a skill spun the goat's hair. And the rulers brought the onyx stones and the stones for setting the ephod and for the breastpiece. and the spice and the oil for the light and for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense. The Israelites, all the men and women whose heart moved them to bring material for all the work which the Lord had commanded through Moses to be done, brought a freewill offering to the Lord. So this is listing the things that people brought, and you cannot miss the redundance here of everyone doing what they were stirred in their hearts to do. They all do this with excitement. They want to bring these things. And it starts out with materials. It starts out with metal. Then it moves to fabric. And then silver and bronze. Then wood. And then it switches and starts talking about labor that they contributed. Those who did the spinning and the weaving. And then it talks about the stones. Then it talks about the spices and the oils. But all of these did this willingly, completely willingly, offering it to the Lord. So this is emphasizing then that many people are contributing to this effort. They're doing so. They're highly motivated to do so. They are excited about doing so. So there's a lot of enthusiasm in response to what God has asked them to do and in the way that God has related to them. Next section. Then Moses said to the sons of Israel, "See, the Lord has called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and he has filled him with the Spirit of God, in wisdom, in understanding, and in knowledge, and in all craftsmanship, to make designs for working in gold, and in silver, and in bronze, and in the cutting of stones for settings, and in the carving of wood, so as to perform in every inventive work. He also has put in his heart to teach, both he and Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach of the tribe of Dan. He has filled them with the skill to perform every work of an engraver and of a designer and of an embroiderer in blue and in purple and in scarlet material and in fine linen, and of a weaver as performers of every work and makers of designs." So there are two individuals in particular, Bezalel, which there is a, just as a side note, there is a street in Jerusalem, Bezalel Street, and it's in an area that is known for the arts, and every Friday, there is an arts and crafts sale that people who create things, they have an outdoor market, and they sell those on Bezalel Street. Bezalel was gifted by God with the skills to be able to make the things that need to be made for the tabernacle. Presumably, these are skills that he learned as a slave in Egypt. Presumably, he was in Egypt doing whatever he was supposed to be doing as a slave, learned these skills, and now he brings that body of knowledge and ability to the task at hand. And I think it's rather interesting to think about that skills that he would be developing in a context where it would be hard to see those as being done in the service of God, and yet to have the opportunity then later to use those in that capacity, that's quite amazing. There is another individual, Aholiab, who also has a bunch of skills. And combined, they seem to have all of the basic skills that are necessary to accomplish what God has asked them to accomplish. But on top of their native ability to do these things, They also have the ability to teach others how to do them. So they are taking the knowledge that they, and skill that they have and teaching that to others, creating an army then of workers who can do the things that need to be done to accomplish the task that God has given them. Pretty amazing. Okay. Now Bezalel and Aholiab and every skillful person in whom the Lord has put skill and understanding to know how to perform all the work in the construction of the sanctuary shall perform in accordance with all that the Lord has commanded. So those are the instructions given, and they go out and do what they were asked to do. Next section, 2-7. Then Moses called Bezalel and Aholiab and every skillful person in whom the Lord had put skill, everyone whose heart stirred him to come to the work to perform it. And they received from Moses all the contributions which the sons of Israel had brought to perform the work in the construction of the sanctuary. And they still continued bringing to him freewill offerings every morning. And all the skillful men who were performing all the work of the sanctuary came, each from the work which he was performing. And they said to Moses, "The people are bringing much more than enough for the construction work which the Lord commanded us to perform." So Moses issued a command, and a proclamation was circulated throughout the camp, saying, "Let neither man nor woman any longer perform work for the contributions of the sanctuary." Thus the people were restrained from bringing any more, for the material they had was sufficient and more than enough for all the work to perform it. So they're bringing raw materials. They're also bringing fabric, I assume, that they have made, things that they have made that go into the construction of the tabernacle. And they're bringing so much that it's more than enough for the tabernacle to be made according to the instructions that they had been given. So people are doing this with a great deal of enthusiasm. They seem to be enjoying this very much. They're overproducing, overfulfilling the plan, and they have to be told to stop, which is, it really underscores how excited they are and motivated to do what God has asked them to do. It's also interesting that Moses says no more. You can see how one could justify, well, we'll make it a little grander. We'll do something a little bit extra. But that's not what Moses did. How far am I going to go? I'll go through the rest of the chapter. So 8-38, a long section. And all the skillful men among those who were performing the work made the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twisted linen and blue and purple and scarlet material with cherubim, the work of a skillful workman. Bezalel made them. The length of each curtain was 28 cubits and the width of each curtain 4 cubits. All the curtains had the same measurements, and he joined 5 curtains to one another, and the other 5 curtains he joined to one another. And he made loops of the blue on the edge of the outermost curtain of the first set. He did likewise on the edge of the curtain that was outermost in the second set. He made 50 loops in the one curtain, and he made 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that was in the second set. The loops were opposite each other. And he made 50 clasps of gold and joined the curtains to one another with the clasps, so the tabernacle was a unit. Then he made the curtains of goat's hair for a tent over the tabernacle. He made the 7 curtains in all. He made 11 curtains in all. The length of each curtain was 30 cubits and 4 cubits the width of each curtain. the 11 cubits had the same measurements. And he joined the 11 curtains had the same measurements. And he joined 5 curtains by themselves and the other 6 curtains by themselves. Moreover, he made 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that was outermost in the first set, and he made 50 loops on the edge of the curtain that was outermost in the second set. And he made 50 clasps of bronze to join the tent together, that it might be a unit. And he made a covering for the tent of ram skins dyed red, and a covering of porpoise skins above. So this is all creating the tent, the fabric for the tent of the tabernacle. Now it's going to describe the boards that are made as the walls inside the tabernacle. Verse 20. Then he made the boards for the tabernacle of acacia wood, standing upright. 10 cubits was the length of each board, and 1.5 cubits the width of each board. There were 2 tenons for each board fitted to one another. Thus he did for all the boards of the tabernacle. And he made the boards for the tabernacle, 20 boards for the south side. And he made 40 sockets of silver under the 20 boards, 2 sockets under one board for its 2 tenons, and 2 sockets under another board for its 2 tenons. Then for the second side of the tabernacle on the north side, he made 20 boards and their 40 sockets of silver, 2 sockets under one board and 2 sockets under another board. And for the rear of the tabernacle to the west, he made 6 boards, and he made 2 boards for the corners of the tabernacle at the rear. And they were double beneath, and together they were complete to its top, to the first ring. Thus he did with both of them for the 2 corners. And there were 8 boards with their sockets of silver, 16 sockets, 2 under each board. Now just to remind you, so he's described making the fabric that stretched over this frame and the leather covering that goes on top of that fabric that stretched over the frame. Then he's describing this wooden frame, so it's like wooden paneling on 3 sides of the interior of the tabernacle. So that's what he's just finished describing. Now it's going to be the bars that these sides are made of, these panels about this wide, and those are all held together by these bars that go on the outside of them. So they're like clamps, I think, that hold these together. So here are the bars. Then he made bars of acacia wood, 5 for the boards of one side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards of the other side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards of the tabernacle for the rear side to the west. And he made the middle bar to pass through in the center of the boards from end to end. And he overlaid the boards with gold and made their rings of gold as holders for the bars, and overlaid the bars with gold. Moreover, he made the veil of blue and purple and scarlet material. So this is the veil that separates the Holy of Holies from the holy place. That's inside the tabernacle. Moreover, he made the veil of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine twisted linen. He made it with cherubim, the work of a skillful workman, and he made 4 pillars of acacia for it and overlaid them with gold and their hooks of gold, and he cast 4 sockets of silver for them. And he made a screen for the doorway of the tent of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine twisted linen, the work of a weaver. And he made its 5 pillars with their hooks, and he overlaid their tops and their bands with gold, but their 5 sockets were of bronze. Okay, so that's at the opening then of the tabernacle, is that screen. Okay, so that's all we'll do of the construction of the implementation for now. Okay. If I'm right, then, what we see in these 2 chapters, and we'll see it going through the next 4 chapters, is Moses is recording the delight that he has and the people have in the fact that they did what God had asked them to do. And the people are coming at this with real enthusiasm. They are highly motivated to do this, eager to do this, and seem to be enjoying doing this. It is interesting that God gave them such a task to do. God could have provided some, could have had some other means by which having a place where God would come and be in their midst, maybe a rock or something that they go out and find. But there could have been something else that would have served the purpose. But instead, God gives them a task, and it's a fairly large task to make all of the pieces that are necessary for this tabernacle. As they go about this task, they are contributing greatly to this. They're giving a lot of their wealth to go towards this, and they're providing labor and doing both of those enthusiastically. In so doing, I think that part of what's happening is after the incident with the golden calf, they are humbled, they are remorseful, and they are extremely grateful for what God has done. God has reconciled with them, and it might not have been that way. And they recognize that it didn't need to be that way. So this gave them an opportunity to express that gratitude. They can do it in a very tangible way, in a very empirical way. Not only can they express this gratitude and making something significant, something they can see, but they can also show their gratitude by doing everything that God asked them to do. Every single thing, and you can check it off on a list. So you can see that at this time, there is a genuine devotion to God that's being expressed by this, by the construction of the tabernacle. And I have found that very significant because there are a handful of passages elsewhere in the Old Testament where it talks about the time in the wilderness as being a time when the people of Israel loved God. A couple of years ago, there were a group of us that were going through Jeremiah. And in Jeremiah 2, verses 2 and 3, it says, "Thus says the Lord, I remember concerning you the devotion of your youth, the love of your betrothals, your following after me in the wilderness, through a land not sown. Israel was holy to the Lord, the first of his harvest. All who ate of it became guilty. Evil came upon them, declares the Lord." And when we were going through Jeremiah, everybody was asking, well, when was it a time when it could be said that there was the devotion of your youth, the love of your betrothals, your following after me in the wilderness? And now I'm beginning to understand where that came from. They're talking about this period of time now when the people of Israel are very grateful to God and very intent on doing what God has told them to do. Later, and I don't know whether it'll be next week or the week after, I want to look at two or three other passages in the Old Testament where it makes a similar kind of comment. And what the picture that emerges is that this period of time in the wilderness is like the honeymoon period of time in the relationship between God and the people of Israel. A period of time when they're supposed to remember and keep that in their memory and reflect upon that. Okay. One other thing I want to talk about is just the fact that God decided to remind them to keep the Sabbath. just before they'd go into the construction. As I've argued, it appears then that what he's saying is, don't allow the construction of this holy place, don't allow that to impinge upon this holy time period, that is, the Sabbath. Which seems to underscore the fact that there is a hierarchy of holy things. Some things are of greater significance, some holy things are of greater significance than other holy things. And I was thinking about that. I've been reading through John, and there, if Jesus heals somebody, you can bet the day of the week is going to be the Sabbath. Jesus heals people on the Sabbath, and his defense is, I'm doing the works of God. Those are holy works that take precedence over the Sabbath. And I'm reminded of David when he was escaping, when they were after him to kill him, King David. And he escapes and he goes to the priest of Nob and he takes the showbread. He asks the priest of Nob for the showbread in the tabernacle. And the priest gives it to him. And there we see, but it was not permitted for David, who was not a priest, to eat the showbread. And so we see there that the escape of God's king takes precedence over the holiness of the showbread. So within things that are holy, there is definitely a hierarchy. So here the Sabbath takes priority over the tabernacle. The Sabbath was the very first thing to be declared holy. And it was made by God, it was not made by man. And man can't change that. The tabernacle, on the other hand, was made by man according to God's instructions. But, as we will see later in the Old Testament, it was either destroyed by man or fell into disrepair. It was replaced by a temple, and that temple was destroyed, which was replaced by another temple, and that temple was destroyed. I don't know all of the significance of that fact, that in this case, the holiness of the time of the Sabbath is greater than the holiness of the place of the tabernacle. But my suspicion is that if I were smarter, I would be able to figure that out. I'm sure it's significant. Okay. Any questions or comments?
Yep. Okay, this is purely curiosity. So with the Canaanite practice of calling something work and not calling something work, I was wondering if one person, like unskilled labor, might be building the fires and then the metal worker comes in and does the metal working, and so that's why it's work. Is there any explanation of why some things are called work and others aren't?
No, not that I'm aware of. It's just there have been some writings found that suggest that this was their practice with respect to defining work, but there's no explanation for why that was significant to them or how they came up with that. There was one more question.
Well, I have two, actually.
Oh, there are two. Okay.
One about the work on the Sabbath was cooking. Wasn't that considered also not so you're not supposed to do that on the Sabbath?
They weren't supposed to kindle a fire.
So that would include cooking and baking and that sort of thing?
Yep.
Okay. And then the other thing was when Moses is talking about all of the craftsmen, did that include women? Or were most of the craftspeople who worked on the tabernacle men?
Well, it says that there were women who were doing the weaving and stuff. So women were playing a part, making those kinds of things. And then as far, it doesn't really say.
It's elusive a little bit, right?
But I would assume that it was men that were doing the metalwork and probably the woodwork. And the women were creating the fabrics.
I was just curious about when it said all the skilled men among the workmen made the tabernacle, and you know, things like that, where I just wondered if the word was specific to men or if it was just craftspeople or...
It
depends, probably.
The word that's used there, yes, is typically just men, but it can be used for a group of people, a generic group of people.
I was curious because, you know, women make garments and whatnot. So
right.
It would have seemed like they would have.
Women were clearly involved, yes.
This this almost reads like it's an archive in case you need it again. I mean, both the first one and the second one is a blueprint. Mm-hmm. And you know, once they got it made, you think, well, okay, we don't need the blueprint anymore. But they preserved it, and I'm almost wondering if there's not a foreshadow of you're going to need this description again, because in 34:10. 11, 12, and he says, I'm gonna do this amazing thing. Be sure to observe what I'm commanding you this day. I'm going to drive out the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. And he says, watch yourself that you make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land into which you are going. So if he's driving them out before them, who are the inhabitants of the land that are going to be there when they occupy it? And I'm getting the feel that it's not like in the movies. This is a long, drawn-out process. This could take a generation or more, and that, you know, you're going to win the wars. I mean, however he's going to get rid of them, he's going to get rid of them, but it's not going to happen overnight. Else there would be no one there to warn them about to not make deals, you know, don't take up their practices, mm-hmm. smash their temples and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And as I read this, what we did, it reminds me of was it Nehemiah that discovered the in the ruins of the temple? They discovered the book, and they read the book before the congregation. They said, "This we shall do."
Are you talking about Josiah?
Was it Josiah? Mm-hmm. And they did for a very short time.
Yep.
Very short time. And so none of this feels permanent. None of this feels like it's going to work. But in the meantime, you said they had this sort of enthusiasm. But it's not enthusiasm for necessarily the right things. It doesn't last.
Mm-hmm.
Their history shows that.
Right.
You know, you get us good and scared after we've seen half our people fall into a hole in the ground. You know, we're warned that you get on this side, you get on that side. We'll snap too for a while.
Right.
We'll be grateful it didn't happen to us. And we'll say, God means business. His name is jealous. And then it just sort of fades away. And it's like, take advantage of their enthusiasm while you got it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they will have this written down to remind them that at one point, you guys thought this was a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
Mm-hmm.
And should it all just get destroyed or carried away, you've got a written model to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of, I get a feeling like that. It's not there, but...
Yeah. Well, as I've been thinking about this, Exodus covers 1 year of time. It's actually a little... we have the story of Moses beforehand, but from the time that Moses goes back to Egypt, well, from the time of the Passover until the tabernacle is all done, that's 1 year. So we've got a picture of 1 year of time. And I think it is significant that Exodus ends there. Because what and I'm going to talk about this more next week, but as I'm understanding Exodus now, I used to think Exodus just kind of peters out at the end. But I'm reading it through different eyes now. It's working up to a crescendo, actually. It's a crescendo of celebration that we did what God asked us to do, and God came and is in our midst. And they're just, it's just amazing. Exodus ends. Now, when we get into Numbers, it's these same people, and they aren't all that wonderful. And certainly when it comes to going into the promised land, as we know, they say, no, we aren't going to go. So these are not perfected people at this point. But for the purposes of telling the story of Exodus, they have come a long way and they are now devoted to God. And I think we are supposed to see that as a significant picture. A picture that will be drawn upon elsewhere in the Old Testament as being a significant picture, a meaningful picture. In these last few chapters, there is no hint of their wickedness. That shows up in Numbers. So it's not gone. It's still there. It's still a part of the reality. But that's not a part of this picture.
So is the message, wouldn't it be nice if it was always like this?
Well, we're going to get to this. I'll talk about this more later, but I'm now convinced Sukkot is built on this. The holiday of Sukkot. People are supposed to build a sukkah, just like they had in the wilderness. And it's the one feast where they are commanded to be happy. So it is a celebration, and that then becomes a picture of, I mean, it's hearkening back to this, but it's a picture of what happens when God is in our midst. God is truly in our midst. He's right there with us. And then that picture is drawn upon in Zechariah and other places. Okay, thanks.